It's great to be with you here tonight. You've been studying the Minor Prophets on Wednesday evening, and we're continuing that tonight. I've been asked to look with you at the book of Zechariah. The book of Zechariah is one of the Minor Prophets. They're called Minor Prophets because of their size, not because of their content. The Major Prophets are also called Major because of their size rather than their content. But even though it's considered minor, Zechariah is the longest of the Minor Prophets. Zechariah actually has 14 chapters, whereas the Major Prophet Daniel only has 12 chapters. But there's a lot more material in the book of Daniel than there is in the book of Zechariah. In the Bible that I'm using, Zechariah takes about 10 pages, and the book of Daniel takes 17 pages. So quite a bit longer for the book of Daniel, even though there are less chapters. But in addition to Zechariah being the longest of the minor prophets, many people believe that it's also the most difficult of all the prophets, including the major prophets. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I do think there are some difficult passages in it. And it apparently does not get taught very often among us. I've never heard anybody teach the book of Zechariah but me, and so I wish that wasn't true, but I just don't think it gets taught even as often as Ezekiel or Jeremiah or Isaiah. I don't think it gets taught. When it does get taught, it's usually taught as a part of a survey of the minor prophets, so it's not really covered in detail. And we're not going to cover it in detail here in the next three evenings either. I don't think there'll be time for that. I do hope we'll have time to at least read it all. We're going to start out at least as though we're going to have time to read it all, and we may have to adjust that as we go along. But it's good to have a reading of it. The book of Zechariah has been called the apocalypse of the Old Testament. The word apocalypsis means to uncover or to lay bare or to make naked. The book of Revelation is the New Testament apocalypse, and the word revelation is translated from the Greek term apocalypsis. The book of Daniel is to some extent apocalyptic as well. In the Old Testament, apocalyptic books are generally characterized by symbolic imagery and visions. Zechariah deals with the future of God's people in Zechariah's time and following Zechariah's time. There is a great messianic thrust to the book of Zechariah. Much is said in this book about the coming of the Messiah. And this book also predicts the triumph of truth generally. The triumph of the cause of God over alien persecuting forces. Now, usually in the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah is called the Messianic Prophet because there's such an abundance of material in Isaiah concerning the coming of the Messiah. But there's actually more about the Messiah proportionately in the book of Zechariah than there is in the book of Isaiah. We're talking about 14 chapters versus 66 chapters. We're talking about 10 pages versus 53 pages in the Bible that I'm using for the book of Isaiah. But proportionately, even though Zechariah is much smaller, there's more about the Messiah in it by proportion. The Lord has woven into the book of Zechariah a lot of material about the Messiah and his kingdom and the ultimate victory of truth over error. And he shines a ray of hope in beautiful imagery. And to appreciate that, we need to understand just a little bit about the background of the book and the historical epoch in which it's found. I brought along a chart of the Old Testament kings and prophets and Joshua. Some of you have seen this chart before, and you may have your own copy of this. If you don't have your own copy of it and you would like to keep this, that's fine. That's what they're for, is for your personal use. If you don't think you have any use for it, then you can give it back. Either way, it's totally up to you. But I'd be very happy for you to have it if you think you can get some good out of it. It's based on Thiel's chronology of the Old Testament kings and prophets. I don't know if you have ever tried, as I have, to make a chart of the kings, the kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Judah, running side by side. And if you're just using the years that the Old Testament gives for those kings, you soon get those two lines out of sync with each other, because when somebody has said you reign 22 years, it doesn't mean precisely 22 years, and there may be some co-regencies and so forth. Anyway, this man named Thiel has come up with a possibility of what might be the solution to the chronology of the Old Testament kings and prophets. This is one way of looking at it. Now, this is not gospel. There are other ways of viewing this period of time, other chronologies that have been made. But this is one, and it's usable, and I like the fact that it's on a little plasticized sheet like this. It can fit easily into a notebook. This is in three strips. If we were to take this top strip on top of this dark, black, thick line, then lay this second strip out underneath it and the third strip underneath that, it would stretch out into a long chart. But this is placed the first tier, the second tier, and the third tier. You can see the chronology there. My reason for passing it out to you at this time is to show you where everything fits in relation to everything else. Up here we have the United Kingdom, Saul, David, and Solomon with 40 years each. Then we have the two kingdoms running concurrently. We come to the end of the 10-tribe kingdom right here in 722 B.C. when the Assyrian nation took them into captivity. Meanwhile, the southern kingdom below kept running on for another century or so. And finally, it goes into Babylonian captivity right down here in the third area. 70 years of Babylonian captivity. And then after the Babylonian captivity, we can see Zechariah and Haggai prophesying right here. They both start at basically the same time, just a couple of months apart. Haggai prophesies for a while, and Zechariah goes on beyond him. So they're right down here after the Babylonian captivity and after the return under Zerubbabel. There's another return under Ezra that you can see right over here. And there's another return under Nehemiah that you can see right over here. 458 and 445 are the years for those. But Zechariah is right in here, starting in 520 and then running along for really quite some period of time. We don't know how old he lived to be, but he was prophesying probably into his old age. At least it would seem so. We don't know near as much about most of these prophets as we would like to. But that gives you an indication of where he was and when he was. The northern kingdom gone and had been gone for a long time. And now the southern kingdom has experienced its Babylonian captivity and has come back, been sent back by King Cyrus, the Persian king, to the promised land. The thrust of the first return in 536 was to rebuild the temple. That's what the Persian king Cyrus sent the children of Israel back to do, or at least the pioneers of them. Most of them didn't go back. 42,360 of them, pioneers, went back to the promised land to rebuild the temple. Remember that God had called Cyrus by name in the book of Isaiah about 140 or 150 years before Cyrus had even come to power in 559 B.C. Cyrus conquered Babylon 20 years after that in 539, and then according to the tradition, Daniel took the book of Isaiah in and showed Cyrus where he'd been predicted by name before he was ever born, which resulted in the issuing of a decree permitting the Jews to return and rebuild the temple. However that may be, whether Daniel showed Cyrus the book of Isaiah or not, Cyrus did issue a decree that sent the Jews back to rebuild the temple. And he even provided these returnees with materials to do that job. So it was quite a thing. The leaders of the 42,360 pioneers who went back to the promised land in the return of 536 B.C. And by the way, they had about 7,000 servants with them that brought the total number up to around 50,000. The leaders of these 42,360 were Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel is also called Sheshbazzar while he was in Babylon. And the leader who was the high priest was called Jeshua, but he's also called Joshua, the high priest. So on the first day of the seventh month in 536, the year that they returned from the Babylonian captivity, They were already starting in getting ready to rebuild the temple. They entered into this project with a great deal of enthusiasm. In the first day of the seventh month of 536, they had already cleared away enough of the rubble to place the altar of burnt offering on its base. Remember, that was not in the tabernacle itself. It was out in front of the tabernacle. I don't know whether you saw it or not, but just recently, and I think it's gone now, but there was a Platte City. Did you see that? Yeah, okay. You went up there? Good. Several of you did. Good. This was a representation that you can see made to scale. And I'm glad you saw it, the ones of you who did. A lot of people are surprised at the size of the altar of burnt offering. One time out at Smart Road, they made wooden exemplars of all these pieces of furniture. And a lot of people were surprised at how small most of them were, but how large the altar of burnt offering is. The altar of burnt offering was so big that they had to cut it in two to get it in the auditorium at Smart Road, in through those double doors. Had to cut it in two and then nail it back together again. Because it was really sizable. And they had that all up at Platte City, just out in somebody's pasture. But you could walk in through the curtains and see the altar of burnt offering there. They had this was just last week that it was there. They had some wood burning in there. But then you go into the tent, which is really fairly small compared to what the temple later would be. And you see this little table and little candelabra, little altar of incense, and then go back through the veil into the area where only the Ark of the Covenant was. It's good to see something that's in size, the same size it was, that you can walk through. Anyway, they made progress on this at the beginning in 536. They were getting ready to rebuild not the tabernacle, but the temple, which was much more sizable. Solomon's temple had been larger than the tabernacle had been. But the altar of burnt offering was out in the courtyard, not in the temple proper. And they already had that set up so that the daily sacrifices could be offered again. We're told about this in the third chapter of the book of Ezra, the beginning of the chapter there. And in the second month of the next year, 535 BC, the foundation of the temple was laid. And we read about this in Ezra chapter 3, verse 8. But you know how projects of this nature are. The festive spirit of joy that they started out with gets dampened by something or other. In this case, part of the issue was the loud lamentations of the older men who had seen and could remember the splendor of Solomon's temple. You'll remember how Solomon's temple was built at the very height of the Israeli administration. David, Solomon's father, had stockpiled gold and silver just all over the place for his son to use. When David found out he wasn't going to be able to build the temple, he helped his son along with this after his own days. And in Solomon's day, silver was just as common as the paving stones of the street. And I don't know how much of an exaggeration that actually is. There was a lot of gold and silver around. So much of this, these precious metals, were used in the building of Solomon's temple. Well, that was simply out of the question in Zerubbabel's time. This was an entirely different situation. So these old men had seen the splendor of Solomon's temple, and they lamented the loss of the outward glory and the rich ornamentation that had been seen in Solomon's temple. This or something dampened the enthusiasm of the people. And then when opposition arose to the building project a little bit later, they only too readily saw that as a good excuse to quit work entirely on the temple. So for 15 years, from 535 to 520 BC, the desire to rebuild the house of God in Jerusalem was almost completely dead. There was hardly anybody who was interested in it. Nobody was talking about it. And it was under these circumstances that God raised up a prophet to be an encourager and to be a motivator to get the temple project going again. And his name was Haggai. I think you've just studied him last week. Ed said you're getting ready for Malachi, so I sort of assumed you did Haggai maybe even just last week. So you're well familiar with what Haggai was about. And he only prophesied for a couple of months. And he left us a two-chapter book that you should have been able to get pretty good coverage of last time, I would think. After that, they needed another prophet who would encourage them along more spiritual lines. And that's where Zechariah fits in. Zechariah began prophesying a couple months after Haggai began. And the thrust of the book of Zechariah is twofold. First, it was designed to bring about a spiritual reformation among God's people in Zechariah's era, during this time when they were rebuilding the temple. That's the main message for that era, is that the temple must be rebuilt because of spiritual reasons, because of what God has done for us. And it was also designed in a larger scale to give glimpses of glory concerning the coming of the Messiah and His kingdom, and to encourage God's people as they went about their work and encourage them to keep on doing this work until they actually got the job done. And it worked, because in 4 years they had the job done. Now, there are a lot of prophecies in the book of Zechariah that nobody claims, nobody that I've ever heard of claims, had a fulfillment in the days of Zechariah. Yet they were given to those people at that time to motivate them in rebuilding the temple and to effect a spiritual reformation. Even though the prophecies were not, many of them were not fulfilled in that day, they were motivational for those people and they were seen as relevant for those people, even though they weren't all going to be fulfilled in that day. The New Testament, as you well know, makes repeated book use of the book of Zechariah, and we should make repeated use of it as well. This book naturally falls into two sections. I don't even know if we need to put this on the board because it's very simple, but part one is chapters 1 through 8. This I at least look at as the first section. And part 2, chapters 9 through 14. We could divide this up a little bit more. But I think these are important just as they stand, because the first part is dated. Every once in a while you have another date given that tells you exactly when, where we are in the chronology. The second part here, 9 through 14, is not dated, and may have been written when Zechariah was a much older man. In the first part of the book, you can argue that he's called a younger man. It's a little obscure because we're not sure who's being spoken of in chapter 2, verse 4. But if it's Zechariah, then he's called a young man there in the first part. In the other part, 9 through 14, he may have been much older. I wish we knew exactly, but we just don't. Now, in the first six chapters, this is I'll just call this part A of part 1. Chapters 1 through 6, we have a series of 8 visions. And those are very interesting visions. They relate to each other. They relate much of it to that time, as well as some messianic prophecies within them. And the fact that these are called visions should lead us to remember that visions happen while we're awake and dreams happen while we're asleep, or while the prophets are asleep. These visions were imprintings by God of scenes on the human mind. This is part of the divers manners that the Hebrew writer speaks of. God, who at sundry times and in divers manners, in many ways, spoke in time past unto our fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by His Son. These visions were part of the divers manners. Dreams were part of the divers manners. And then chapters 7 and 8 will be part B here. Chapters 7 and 8 deals with the issue of fasting, which there had been a question that was raised about this at that time. So it deals with the issue of fasting and the Lord's response to fasts and so forth. And then in chapters 9 through 14, the second part of the book, we have two burdens, as they're called. Two burdens in this second part. And these have a general thrust toward the Messiah and His kingdom, prophesying the Lord and His church in terms of Old Testament times, but really looking ahead to New Testament times, using the then current local scene, 500 years before Christ, becomes the basis for contemplating the universal picture of the kingdom of the Messiah. So that's a little survey of the book of Zechariah. Now we can take a more analytical look at it by beginning in chapter 1. Chapter 1. Anybody got any questions or thoughts? I should have said at the beginning, anytime you have something you want to ask or say, that's fine. Yeah, Paul?
Would they have brought the animals for the sacrifice from Babylon? They
may have herded some of them across there, but I would think that they would get them after they got there. In general, it's easier to buy them after you get there than it is to take them all the way up through the Fertile Crescent, because you couldn't go across the desert. So they have to take them all the way up through the Fertile Crescent and then down, and you're talking about a journey of a lot of miles. So you drive animals that far, you have to go slower than you would otherwise. And even in the days of Christ, as you know, rather than bring an animal from home, even if you lived in the Promised Land, many people would go down there and buy one. So I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect that they bought them after they got there. There were people living in this area. Some of them turned out to be enemies of the work of God, but they would have had animals to sell. Good question. Anybody else? Okay. Let's take a look at chapter 1 here. And I think I'll just read the first 6 verses. In the 8th month, in the 2nd year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, The Lord hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say thou unto them, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Turn ye unto me, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will turn unto you, saith the Lord of hosts. Be not as your fathers, unto whom the former prophets have cried, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, Turn ye now from your evil ways and from your evil doings. But they did not hear, nor hearken unto me, saith the Lord. Your fathers, where are they? And the prophets, do they live forever? But my words and my statutes, which I command with my servants the prophets, did they not take hold of your fathers? And they returned and said, Like as the Lord of hosts thought to do unto us, according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. So this is a little introduction to the book. The year that's referenced here as the 2nd year of Darius is 520 B.C. We're in the 8th month. This is 2 years after the call of Haggai. But one of the things that makes the identity of some of the people called Zechariah in the Bible confusing is that there are at least 27 Zechariahs in the Bible. There may be as many as 29, depending on who is actually who, and we can't always untangle that the way we would like to. But there are at least 16 Zechariahs in 1st and 2nd Chronicles alone. So it was a very common name back in these times, just like the name Bill or Mike or John would be in our time. We all know lots of people with all of those names. Zechariah was a very common name that meant the Lord remembers. And the prophet's name is also the theme of his message. Jehovah remembers his covenant with his people. God remembers his law, and he does not forget his promise. Zechariah is listed here as the son of Berechiah and the grandson of Iddo. Ezra calls him the son of Iddo. As we know, the word son can also mean grandson or can mean descendant of somebody. That's in Ezra chapter 5, verse 1. Iddo was the head of one of the priestly families who returned with Zerubbabel. And we can read about that in Nehemiah chapter 12, verses 1 through 47. Evidently, Zechariah's father, Berechiah, died before his grandfather, Iddo, did, so that Zechariah succeeded Iddo as the head of his family. The last dated prophecy in the book of Zechariah occurs in the 4th year of Darius. We see this in chapter 7, verse 1, and that's about 518 B.C. As I've said before, we don't know how long Zechariah continued his prophetic activity, and that's why on your chart here you have an open-ended timeline. You have a beginning here in 520 because we know when he began, so they close the line there. But at the end, it's open-ended because we don't know how long that line should really go on. We don't know how the man died or when the man died. It's just one of those biographical things that are left out because the emphasis in the Bible is always on the message rather than being on the human messenger. There's no difference here than there is in the Apostle Paul. We don't know from the Bible when Paul died or how he died either. History tells us something about that, but that what it tells us may or may not be true. The emphasis is on the message, and this book contains quite a message. For more than 2,000 years, the book of Zechariah was universally regarded as all being written by this man, Zechariah, the son of Berechiah. He was regarded as the author of the entire book. It was not until 1644 that the authorship of chapters 9 through 14 was challenged. It was challenged by a man by the name of Hugo Grotius, because he said that the style of it and the content of it are entirely different. I don't think that's really true, but that's what Grotius said, and got some little following at that time. Anyway, since 1644 and through the years since, theories have abounded as to who wrote chapters 9 through 14 and when they were written. And it seems like each successive theory refutes the predecessor of that theory while failing to establish its own claim. The truth is that there are a lot of evidence for the unity of the entire book. I'm not even planning to take time to talk about that, because I don't think there's anybody here who doubts that Zechariah wrote it all. I certainly have no doubt that Zechariah wrote it all. There are a lot of expressions and phrases, some of them that are rather rare, which are found in both sections 1 through 8 and 9 through 14. I don't think there's the slightest reason to reject the ancient belief, which was held both by the Jews and then later by the church, that Zechariah is the writer of this book that bears his name. In verses 2 through 4 here, we see that the one who searches the hearts sees the beginning of the rebellious spirit of the fathers in their refusal of the present generation to build the temple. You're acting too much like your fathers used to act in refusing to build the temple. So God says to them, turn to me and I will turn to you. Much like James chapter 4 verse 8. Draw nigh to God and he will draw nigh to you. Same message back here in the Old Testament. God is telling them in essence, there's no enemy around you that's so strong, but what I am stronger than that enemy. There's no obstacle so great in the building of the temple, but what I can remove it. And I want you to do this work, and so I'm going to help you do it. The former prophets are referenced here, and they're mentioned several other times in this book as well. In fact, later on, the fact that the former prophets are mentioned a lot helps us to understand one of the difficult passages in that later portion of the book. In verses 5 and 6, he says, where are your fathers? And the answer is, they're dead and buried. And the prophets who warned them no longer personally speak to you. But my words, spoken by my prophets, as my mouths, they have proven to be true. Your fathers did not heed them, and your fathers were dealt with accordingly. This is a Bible principle. We each choose the course that we will take, but we cannot choose the consequences independently of that course. It's a package deal. As you sow, so you reap. And that's basically what these people are being told. Your fathers behaved in a certain way. They went contrary to my words, and you've seen what happened to them. Now it's your time to decide. Are you going to go according to my words or not? You were delivered from the Babylonian captivity at the exact time that had been foretold by God. Now you're back and you should willingly build his house. That's the message here. And the next revelation was received 3 months later, and it is the first of the 8 visions. We find it in verses 7 through 17. We okay? All right. Let's read verses 7 through 17. This is the first vision. Upon the 24th day of the 11th month, which is the month Sebat, in the second year of Darius, came the word of the Lord unto Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom, and behind him there were red horses, speckled and white. Then said I, O my Lord, what are these? And the angel that talked with me said unto me, I will show thee what these be. And the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, these are they whom the Lord hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth. And they answered the angel of the Lord that stood among the myrtle trees and said, we have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest. Then the angel of the Lord answered and said, O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou had indignation these 70 years, these 70 years? And the Lord answered the angel that talked with me with good words and with comfortable words. So the angel that communed with me said unto me, cry thou, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, my cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and the Lord shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. All right. Just a few notes about this first vision. First of all, the month Sebat, mentioned in verse 7, sometimes is called Shebat, and it's a Babylonian name for the 11th month. We're talking here about February 519 B.C., as it would be on our calendar. In verse 8, he talks about the night of the 24th day, and we need to keep in mind that it's different from our nights. Our nights come after our day. We're in night right now, but it comes after the daylight time because we reason from midnight to midnight. In the way they counted time then, the night of the 24th day was the night preceding the sunrise of that day. So you'd have the night first, and then you'd have the sun, and when the sun ended, then that was the night of the next day. So the night came first. The evening and the morning were the first day, and the evening and the morning preceded on the days after that. So at this time, during the night time, which would to us be very early in the morning, but it's the dark time of the night, Zechariah begins to get these audio-visual revelations that he's going to see several of. I have tried to represent these in the past as being like something in a theater in the round, which is not actually happening, but yet you see it all around you. Most of you have probably been at a theater in the round at a place like Worlds of Fun or Disney World or Disneyland. There are more and more of these around these days where you have screens all around you and you can really get involved in the action. I think that's the way that they were. These are the divers' manners. God used every form of revelation to drive home truth. The visions came during the night, but they did not come during the form of dreams because they happened while Zechariah is awake rather than while he's asleep. And when Zechariah does become exhausted and falls asleep, the angel rouses him to full wakefulness and alertness because he's going to have visions that happen while he's awake. Now, all of these eight visions apparently were seen during one night. I can't prove that for sure, but that's sure the way it reads to me. Chapter 4, verse 1 leads me to that conclusion, as well as the way the visions just follow one right after another through the next few chapters. Zechariah does not always understand what's going on in these visions, as he frankly confesses 12 different times. He says, what's this? What's going on? Or somebody will ask him, what is this? And he'll say, oh, I don't know. It seems like the angel is trying to keep him involved in this and to make him work mentally. God's not going to give you something without you working at it. That's the idea here. And God will fill in where you need help, but you need to work at understanding what he has to say to you. Before the prophets were called prophets, they were also called seers, 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 9, because they saw things that others did not see. There were people around, but Zechariah is the only one seeing these visions. God caused Zechariah to see them, opening his eyes to what he would not have otherwise seen. There's a close logical coherence between the individual visions, particularly between vision 2 and vision 3, and vision 4 and vision 5, vision 6 and vision 7, and vision 8 and vision 1. 8 and 1 are like the bookends that kind of tie the whole series together. So here we have the vision of the man among the myrtles, and it's not my intention to spend too long on any one of these visions because we have a limited amount of time to talk about these things, but yet I want to spend enough time on each one that we can kind of see what was happening there. The man among the myrtles. The myrtle tree is a beautiful ornamental tree, grows from 8 to 20 feet high, and it has small, glossy, green leaves and delicate, fragrant, white flowers. Now, in our time, the myrtle has been bred in various ways so that it can be all different kind of colors. Some of you have phones with you right now where you could plug in, you could just say myrtle tree photos, and you'd see all different colors of myrtle trees. But the myrtle trees that they're talking about here had little white flowers. They were really, really beautiful, and they were very common in Israel. Just grew wild along the hills and along the streams of Israel. It was also cultivated in Israel back in these years in gardens and parks as these pioneers began to put things back together again. The myrtle tree is an age-old symbol of joy and peace. They would go out and pick the flowers of the myrtle tree to be worn by brides on their wedding days. The branches of the myrtle tree were used for constructing booths at the time of the Feast of Tabernacles. So it was an integral part of life in the Promised Land through the Jewish era. Esther's Jewish name was Hadassah, and Hadassah means myrtle. Esther chapter 2, verse 7 is a reference concerning that. Now, the horse, in general, seems to often be used as a symbol of warfare. It was used in warfare in those days. It was not regarded as a beast of burden. The ox and the donkey were the plow pullers of those days. But the horse was used in war. Red is the color of bloodshed. White is the color of victory and purity. Speckled, which may be the same as grizzled or bay or sorrel. Bay and sorrel are a little bit different from each other. If you're a horse person, you know that because there's a distinction made. Bay is darker red than sorrel is. Sorrel is a little lighter, a sort of a reddish brown. But really, I think that all comes under this speckled and maybe is signifying scarcity or even famine or other plagues that accompanied war. These red, white, and speckled horses seem to represent the agencies that God employs for the correction and punishment of people. And we see these horses at various times historically. We see them again in the sixth chapter of the book of Revelation, where they have a specific representation there related to the Roman Empire. But they're back here just kind of as a reconnaissance troop. That's the impression I get from verses 9 through 11. They are a reconnaissance troop sent out by the Lord to inspect the earth. What is the status of things right now? And the word earth and land are both from the same word. I think it's inspecting in particular this area where God is trying to get the people to rebuild the temple. What's going on there right now? To send these horses out and let them inspect it. And they observe, these horses observe, that all the earth sits still and is at rest. This is important because Haggai, as you know from last week and maybe from other studies, Haggai had promised that the Lord is going to shake heaven and earth. Yet once more, I shake not the earth only, but also heaven, it was said back there. And that's quoted in the Hebrew letter. But now the people learn that this isn't going to occur in a matter of a few days or even in months or years. Right now there is peace, and there is peace so that the temple can be rebuilt. So this is a vision, the man among the myrtles, that's giving the green light, giving the go-ahead signal to resuming and completing the building of the Lord's temple. This was very important to the Lord, and it became very important to the prophets that the Lord called. In verse 11, we see this mysterious personage known as the angel of the Lord. And Lord is all capitalized, meaning Jehovah or Yahweh. The angel of the Lord, as opposed to an angel of the Lord, this is the angel of the Lord, the angel of Jehovah. Obviously, as we've seen in our studies before, there's nothing about the word angel, which is Malak, M-A-L-A-K, in the Old Testament, and Angelos in the New Testament. There's nothing about that word in either Hebrew or Greek that tells you who it is. The word in either language just means messenger. Many people think that this angel of the Lord is actually the pre-incarnate Word of God, the second person of the Godhead appearing in angelic form before the incarnation. And you can see why people think that, because this individual is said to be one with Jehovah, and we have him from Genesis on. It would be possible to do a complete study of this, but that's outside the province of our study of the book of Zechariah. But just to mention a few things, in Exodus chapter 23, verse 20 and following, he says, "My name is in him." that name which he said was his own name forever in Exodus 3:14, belongs to this angel. This is the name that he will not give to another, Isaiah 42, verse 8, and yet this angel seems to have this name. He's called the angel of the presence, Isaiah 63, verse 9, literally the angel of his face. They who look upon this angel are said to look upon Jehovah. The presence of this angel, Jehovah, is in the presence of this angel, it seems that Jehovah is present. He calls himself, this angel calls himself the God of Bethel. He accepts sacrifices that are offered to God. Hagar in the book of Genesis recognizes in this angel the Lord, Jehovah. And Abraham recognizes the same thing. Jacob recognizes the same thing. So, though one with Jehovah in the undivided and the invisible, indivisible unity of God's essence and being, he is the second person, not the first person. He is Jehovah sent by Jehovah as Jehovah's messenger. We have here the same unsearchable unity in essence and duality of persons to which Jesus was referring to when he said, I and the Father are one in John 10 verse 30. While just as clearly he states that the Father has sent him into the world. So they're different persons and yet they have a unity about them. It seems that Jehovah is a family name. He consistently identifies himself with the Lord, this angel does, and is recognized as divine by those to whom he appears. And when you're looking next week at Malachi, in Malachi chapter 3, verse 1, he clearly identifies the angel of the Lord with the one for whom John the Baptist prepared the way, the covenant angel. Now, another view of this angel is that as the Lord's personal messenger who represented him and bore his credentials, this angel could speak on behalf of Jehovah and so be identified with the one who sent him without actually being the pre-incarnate word. So opinions are divided on whether this was actually the second person of the Godhead or whether this was an angel like the Archangel Michael. One of those is probably true, and you can each make up your minds individually as to what you think about that. I don't know. I don't think it's something that we have to agree on, and it might not even be something that you need to make up your mind about. But those are two views about this angel of Jehovah. I mention that in some detail because over and over again, this personage is mentioned back here, and we have something about that now under our belt. In verse 12, there's a reference made to these 70 years. I don't know if that refers to the 70 years of exile or not, if we're thinking from 606 to 536, which Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were taken captive in the first captivity in 606, and then coming down to 536, these pioneers, 42,360 pioneers, were allowed to come back. That is the 70 years of captivity. But this 70 years may be referring to the 70 years beginning with the actual destruction of the city of Jerusalem and with the actual destruction of the temple, which now is supposed to be rebuilt. And that was in 586 BC. This was the third major captivity. This was the time when the temple was actually destroyed and the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. So that 70-year period of time, beginning with the destruction of the city and the destruction of the temple, goes from 586 to 516. 516 is the very year when this second temple is completed. That's probably, I think, the 70 years that he's talking about here, because they're still within that. They're right toward the end of it, but they're still within that 70 years. So he says these 70 years, which we're still in. It's not been yet completed. In 520, Judah has not yet recovered from this longest and severest period of ruin in its history. Verse 15 shows us that God was displeased with the cruel way his people had been treated. Yes, God used the Babylonians to bring about this captivity, but the Babylonians did not have to treat the people as cruelly as they did. We have numerous examples in the Old Testament as to how bitterly cruel the Babylonian captivity was for the people and what the motives behind that were. Kind of reminds us of Jehu. God commissioned Jehu, one of the kings of Israel, to execute vengeance against the house of Ahab, but Jehu did a little too good a job with that and for wrong motivations. And the Lord didn't like that either. So I think that's the same type of thing here. Yes, the Babylonians were doing what they did at the prediction of God, and God was using the Babylonians as his willow switch to spank his people. But the Babylonians got too cruel about it. I think that's what's being said in verse 15. Verses 16 and 17 emphasize that the Jerusalem, the city, and the temple will be rebuilt, and that it was important for this to occur, because this second temple was going to be the one, even though Herod remodeled it, but it was still the same temple. This was the one where the incarnate Son of God would be presented at that temple. This was the temple at which, as a young boy, he was going to cause the learned doctors of the law to marvel. This is the place from which he was going to drive the money changers, this temple they're getting ready to build right now. It's the one from which the Lord would drive the money changers. This is the temple where he would preach and perform miracles. This is the Jerusalem that they're getting ready to rebuild, that he would enter as her king. Here, the first fruits of the Gentile world would come to Philip and say, we would see Jesus. So even the Gentiles got interested at a very early time. It's from this Jerusalem that's about to rebuild that the church was going to spread to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to Judea, to Samaria, to the uttermost parts of the earth. But rather than rebuilding this temple and then this Jerusalem, rather than doing that, the Jews are just fooling their time away. They're sitting around twiddling their thumbs, building houses for themselves and so forth. And the Lord wants to get them off of that and get them to doing the work that he sent them there to do. So that's the first vision, the one of the man among the myrtles. If we're ready for number two, it's only four verses long. And you just tell me, I won't stop for questions too often, you just tell me, just raise your hand or speak out. Bill, go ahead.
What was the measuring line? Did I miss it? Or...
No, that just is a thing that's used in construction, and I think that's all it's talking about there. This is going to be rebuilt, surveying will be done, measuring will be done, plumb lines will be used to get everything exactly right. Yeah, good question. And please ask those kind of questions if you have them. Bill asked, what about the measuring line that down there in the latter part of this vision? And it's just talking about the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem and the temple itself. You couldn't do it without a plumb line. You try to put up a stone wall without some kind of a line to be sure that it's plumb, and it's going to fall over. So just talking about the way that this would be done. Okay, excellent. Verse 18, the second vision, for 18 through 21. Then lifted I up mine eyes and saw, and behold, four horns. And I said unto the angel that talked with me, what be these? And he answered me, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And the Lord showed me four carpenters, or smiths. Then said I, what come these to do? And he spake, saying, these are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head. But these are come to fray them, to cast out the horns of the Gentiles, which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah, to scatter it. And that is the second vision. Four horns and four carpenters are all that we have here. There's an interesting predilection for the number four in the book of Zechariah. We've got eight visions, which is four times two, night visions. We've got four colors of horses. We've got four horns, four carpenters or smiths, four chariots, four winds, four men in chapter 6, verse 14, four fast days. You can go on with a lot of different fours here in the book of Zechariah. And I think it's important to note that four is the number that has to do with God's work on the earth. Three is the number for God. God is complete in three, Father, Word, and Holy Spirit. But four is the number of the earth, and especially also God's work on the earth, or things having to do with the earth. There are four basic directions, north, south, east, and west. The book of Revelation talks about the four corners of the earth in chapter 7 and the four quarters of the earth in chapter 20. There's a lot of times that four are used with reference to the earth. Now, the horn is a symbol of power. My grandpa used to be a cowboy down in Texas, herding longhorn steers, and he said, you don't get off your horse, or if you do, you really have to watch out for those horns, because that's where the power of a steer is, in his horn. There's not a whole lot he's going to do to you otherwise, unless he might be able to trample you if you're on the ground. But basically, it's those horns that can gore clear through you. It's the horn where the power is. And so the horn, then, of an animal in the Old Testament and New represents a power. And we find this Old Testament and New alike in symbolic language. The way the ox could protect himself was by his horns. We're not told whether these four horns were attached to something or whether they were just floating in the air or what. Zechariah said he saw four horns. He didn't say that he saw them attached to anything. And verse 19 indicates that these are the powers that have afflicted God's people. And then in verse 20, we see four carpenters, which the original word here is a little broader than what we would think of as a carpenter. These are craftsmen or smiths or artisans, and that's true whether they're working with wood, as we would think of a carpenter doing, or working with stone or working with metal. This is a little broader expression than just what we would think of as a carpenter. We see prophesied here the defeat and the destruction of every force opposing the people of God. For every oppressor, there is a destroyer. There's four horns, so there's four carpenters, one for each. Four is the number of completeness on earth, and especially where God's work is concerned, as we have said. These four horns may very well be the ones that have so far, in 520 B.C., the ones that have so far enslaved the people of God. Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, and Persia. Those are the ones so far, those are the four, all manifesting the same spirit. Civilization does not die, it migrates from one place to another. And the Jews were still under Persian control while this was being written. We've got to remember that even though Cyrus sent these pioneers back to the Promised Land, Cyrus controlled the Promised Land the same as he controlled the place where he sent them from in Mesopotamia. So Cyrus was simply transferring this remnant of 42,360 to another part of his empire. They were still under Persian control just as much when they got there as they had been when he sent them out of Mesopotamia, still under his dominion. So these four horns still apply. The point here is that there's nothing impeding the building of the Lord's house except the Jews themselves. God will take care of any of your enemies. Don't worry about that. Just do this building project. So we see the same basic point here being made in the second vision as was made in the first vision. Indeed, we'll see this point other times as well. Zechariah's first purpose under God is to get the temple rebuilt and to encourage the people to rebuild it. Now, in chapter 2, we have the third vision, and it's the entire chapter, verses 1 through 13. It's the man with the measuring line, which is going to be along the same lines, but from a little different point of view, too. In vision 1, we've seen horses, worldwide power for the subjection of the nations. In chapter 2, we've seen horns, these powers being hammered into subjection. And now we get to the building with this measuring line. I guess I'll go ahead and read this chapter. It's just a short chapter, and I hate to just talk about it without setting it before our minds in spite of the time that it takes. We may get to the place where we won't be able to read everything, but for now, let's just read. Chapter 2. I lifted up mine eyes again and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Then said I, whither goest thou? And he said unto me, to measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof, and what is the length thereof. And behold, the angel that talked with me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him. And he said unto him, run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein. For I, saith the Lord, will be unto her a wall of fire around about, and will be the glory in the midst of her. Ho, ho, come forth, and flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord. For I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, saith the Lord. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughter of Babylon. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations. After the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. For behold, I will shake mine hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants. And you shall know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me. Sing and rejoice, O daughter of Zion, for lo, I come, and I will dwell in the midst of thee, saith the Lord. And many nations shall be joined to the Lord in that day, and shall be my people. And I will dwell in the midst of thee, and thou shalt know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto thee. And the Lord shall inherit Judah, his portion in the holy land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. Be silent, O all flesh, before the Lord, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation. This is the third vision, the second chapter, the man with the measuring line. And we see in verse 2 that the prophet is not merely an idle spectator. He is deeply involved in this. He may be the young man that's mentioned in verse 4. I think that's possibly Zechariah. It may be the man with the measuring line that he sees, though. So I can't be sure that he's talking about Zechariah, but it seems like to me that he is. The idea here of being without walls is a time of peace and harmony so that you don't need walls. Now, physical Jerusalem was going to have walls in just a few years. But there is something spiritual being said here. In verse 5, the wall of fire is the Lord himself. We have a song in our Red Songbooks, number 207, called The Lily of the Valley. In that song, The Lily of the Valley, we sing, a wall of fire about me, I've nothing now to fear. With his manna, he my hungry soul shall fill. And many people through the years have thought that the wall of fire was our enemies, but we've nothing to fear because of the Lord. But the wall of fire is actually the Lord himself protecting us from the enemies. The wall of fire is the Lord himself. So here it's being spoken of not only as physical Jerusalem, but spiritual Jerusalem, the church, comes into play here. These are the villages without walls because of the way the Lord takes care of his people. Now, the north that's mentioned in verse 6 is referring to Assyria and Babylon, because to get to the promised land from Assyria or Babylon, you would come from the north. You couldn't go across the desert because you just didn't make it across there. It's too big a desert. So you come up north through the Fertile Crescent and then down from the north into the promised land. God's people are scattered all over the earth. This is an invitation to the Jews who are scattered in foreign countries to do what the 42,360 have just done, to return to the promised land, being in the world but not of it. The same idea as we have in the church. Come ye out from among them and be separate, and touch not the unclean thing. Return to God's promised land is the idea here. The phrase, the apple of the eye in verse 8, has come into the English language as common parlance. The idea is that the eye is the most sensitive part of the body, really, that we have. People who are ophthalmologists and have studied the eye in detail for years will tell you, and you can ask Kent Nofsinger, who many of you know, about this. He's an ophthalmologist, or used to be, and I suppose still is credited as one, and teaches about the eye now. These people say that the only purpose of the rest of the body is to keep the eye from dragging the ground. You know, the eye is very sensitive and very important. It has our most important sense, the sense of sight, within it. So to be as the apple of the eye is to be somebody that's very carefully guarded against any harm. The pupil of your eye is so delicate. You shield your eye. If somebody throws something, you're not protecting your chest from a handful of gravel. You're protecting your eyes. That's what we protect first. And we protect it at all cost. He who plunders you plunders that which is most precious to me. That's what God is saying here. I will keep you as the apple of my eye. I'm on your side. Thus saith the Lord of hosts. He hath sent me. Once again, we have this close correlation between the angel of the Lord and the Lord of hosts who has sent him. The Lord of hosts has sent me, but yet the Lord of hosts is the one who is sent. The messenger sent by the Lord is also called the Lord of hosts in verse 9. Verse 10, the angel of Jehovah is simultaneously identified as Jehovah. I'm coming, he says. I'm coming to Jerusalem. And in chapter 9, we'll see that he actually rides in. And it's a messianic prediction in chapter 9 when we get there. Verse 11, again, he says, Jehovah sent me. So somebody called Jehovah is speaking, but somebody called Jehovah sent him. Jehovah is a family name. And I have no problem personally with this being the pre-incarnate Christ. If you want to believe that it's the Archangel Michael, that might be right too. I don't think we have enough information to actually make a definitive, declarative statement about it, but I've told you what makes sense to me. Anyway, the main message here is the universality of the gospel message. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, said our Lord when he was getting ready to leave. Matthew 28:18 and following. Teach all nations, Jews and Gentiles alike. It's a picture of them pouring into the family of God. In verse 12, interestingly, this is the only place in the whole Bible where the expression the Holy Land is used. When I was growing up, I heard all the time about the Holy Land. Brother Brumbeck had been over to the Holy Land and wrote a book about the Holy Land. Heard about it all the time. But it's only mentioned, those three words in that order, only mentioned one time in the Bible, and it's right here in verse 12. In the New Testament, God's land is not restricted geographically. God creates Holy Land wherever he dwells in believers. He's got some Holy Land right here while his people are here. So that's the third vision, comprising all of chapter 2. The fourth vision is chapter 3, just 10 verses there. The entire chapter 3 is the fourth vision. Joshua, the high priest, and Satan are involved in this vision. We have a scene involving Joshua, the high priest. Yes, Dale.
Back in verse 11, it says, many nations shall join themselves to the Lord that day.
Yes.
To be my people. What does he say?
I think this is a messianic prediction about the Gentiles coming into... Denny's telling me to repeat. The statement in verse 11 about... many nations shall be joined to the Lord. I believe this is a messianic prediction about the coming of the Gentiles into the church in the New Testament times. This process begins even earlier than we might think, with Greeks coming to Philip and saying we would see Jesus. There was always an interest in this. And then when the church gets going, it's not long before the Gentiles come in the household of Cornelius.
The first six words you mentioned come from the north.
Yes.
Is that both present and future? He's talking about come now to Jerusalem?
I think he's talking about come now from to Jerusalem. And you come from the north because while the Jews were all over the world at this point, they were primarily in Assyria and Babylonia. And to get to the promised land, they would have to come from the north.
Messianic.
I don't think it's messianic there, no. But it blends in to a messianic prophecy at the end of it. And many of these prophecies do that. They're talking about physical Jerusalem, and then it blends into spiritual Jerusalem. And sometimes it can be a little difficult to tell which is mentioned, but that's one of the things we're trying to sort out. Good questions. Anything else so far? Yeah, Ed?
One picture or sense I get is that maybe the young man who's going out with the measurement, he's thinking material. He's thinking foundations, walls, stones, mantles, and all this that make a community where God said, hey, this is bigger, this city, this is worldwide, my worldwide right. Kingdom, who has no boundaries, no walls.
Absolutely. God had wanted to make a kingdom of priests clear back in Exodus at Mount Sinai. And the children of Israel would not do that. They were not mature enough yet. And so he's using Judaism to keep the idea of monotheism alive until he can bring his son into the world. But this is all of one piece in God's eyes. He has this Jewish nation, but he still has a Jewish nation. He still has what's now called the Israel of God, Galatians 6:16. We are the Israel of God. Whether we're of Jewish ancestry or Gentile ancestry, we're the Israel of God now. Believing Jews and Gentiles, like in Romans 9, the vessels of mercy versus the vessels of wrath fitted to destruction that were physical Israel who would not have Jesus when he came unto his own and his own received him not. That's an excellent point because God sees this as all of one piece. We're building physical Jerusalem, getting the temple, physical temple in place, building the physical city of Jerusalem with a view to this gospel being spread abroad from there throughout all the earth where we can finally take the emphasis off the physical and put it on the spiritual where God had wanted it to be all along. Excellent. Yeah, Barb.
Throughout these chapters, Is Lord there referring to El Shaddai, the nourisher?
When El Shaddai is used, yes, or when Adonai is used, it's referring to somebody other than Jehovah. But wherever you have capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, in most translations at least, that's referring to Yahweh or Jehovah himself. That name of God that's found over 6,000 times in the Old Testament. Not mentioned until the second chapter of Genesis. In the first chapter of Genesis, he's always Elohim. But starting in Genesis 2, it's mentioned 6,000 times in the Old Testament, by far more than any other name. So when you see capital L, lowercase O-R-D, then that's another name for God, either Adonai or El Shaddai. But capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, as far as I know, is always Yahweh or Jehovah. And these names of God are an interesting study in themselves. And I think we have, way back a long time ago maybe, studied just the names of God together. You got some notes there. Good. Good. But when it's all caps, it's the most common name, Jehovah, which is God's connection with his people. Used to talk just about that relationship, God's connection with his people. Good questions. Anything else, or shall we go on? Okay. Chapter 3 is the fourth vision. Let me just read these 10 verses, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. He showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And the Lord said unto Satan, The Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. And he answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, Take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with change of raiment. And I said, Let them set a fair mitre upon his head. So they set a fair mitre upon his head and clothed him with garments. And the angel of the Lord stood by. And the angel of the Lord protested unto Joshua, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, If thou wilt walk in my ways, if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among these that stand by. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant the branch. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall ye call every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree. Okay. Joshua the high priest had come back out of the Babylonian captivity along with the rest of the 42,360. In verse 1, he's standing before the messenger of Jehovah, and Satan is standing at his right hand. Anytime you see Satan standing nearby, you know there's bad business afoot. And this time was no different. He was standing there to be his adversary, which is what the word Satan means, to be his adversary, to resist him. In Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, we see Satan there is our adversary, to accuse. The word devil means accuser. Satan means adversary. So in chapter 12, verse 10 of Revelation, he's both the devil and Satan, the adversary to accuse us before God. He's always ready to do that. In the fourth chapter of the book of Matthew, Jesus went into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil, and we're told that the always tempting one came unto him. He's a roaring lion, always seeking those whom he may devour. This is his habitual, unceasing activity. Joshua is called in verse 2 a brand plucked from the fire, a brand plucked from the burning. Joshua was the grandson of Seraiah. Seraiah was the last high priest before the temple was destroyed. his grandfather Sariah had been killed by Nebuchadnezzar, and we have record of this. His father Jehozadak had been dragged away into exile. So Joshua now has come back. In verse 3, we see that he's clothed with filthy garments. And this is the basis for Satan's accusation. Satan is suggesting that this man, Joshua, is not worthy of God's attention and of God's redemption. Because look how he's dressed. He's clothed in filthy garments. So he's maligning the high priest. He charges God with having made a mistake in rescuing this brand from the burning, as well as the other 42,359 that God has rescued as pioneers to come back to the promised land. In verse 4, the Lord speaks up and says, take those filthy garments from Joshua and put some new clean garments on him. These are festal garments. These are holy garments for glory and for beauty, as we have when they were originated in Exodus chapter 28, worn by the high priest whenever he served in the temple. The God of absolute holiness is also the God of grace. There's no conflict between the two. He does not relinquish one iota of his holiness when he shows his grace, but that's only possible through the great high priest which Joshua was representative of. Joshua is really standing there representing the great high priest who is to come. In verse 5, this mitre or turban, the crowning headgear of the high priest made of white linen, on this turban was fashioned a plate of pure gold with the inscription, Holiness to the Lord. The high priest represented the entire sinful nation. That's why he's standing there in filthy garments. His absolution and his reacceptance includes that of the nation as well. The nation is standing in sin before God, but God is going to redeem them. God has burnt out of them their idolatry with the Babylonian captivity. He's getting ready to accept them back. In verses 6 and 7, Joshua is informed of the need for personal righteousness as well as official faithfulness. High priest in the past, up to this time, had been disappointing. We know the story of Eli and how disappointing he was in 1 Samuel. We know the story of Abiathar and how disappointing he was in 1 Kings. Access to the sanctuary was only to the priest when they were in a state of ritual purity. They had to wash at the laver to go in there, the same as we wash in baptism to come into the church. So he was greatly wondered at in verse 8. He's wondered at. In other words, he is a sign. He was symbolic of something that is to come. What is he symbolic of? He's symbolic of my servant, the branch. And this ties us right into messianic prophecies in other portions of the Old Testament. This is the same person who in Isaiah 11:1 is called the branch. That shoot out of the stock of Jesse. There will come a shoot out of the stock of Jesse. And there's quite a lot said in the 11th chapter of Isaiah about him. So what's being said here is that the priesthood symbolized something far more than had yet been discerned by the people of Israel. Joshua and his fellow priests are types prefiguring the New Testament high priest and the New Testament royal priesthood, which is us. That shoot, that sprout, that branch, God caused him to sprout, implanting him in a mysterious manner into mankind. Who knew at this point that there was going to be a virgin birth? Who really understood that this was still yet to come? He was going to fulfill all kinds of marvelous achievements implied in the office of the high priest and revive the significance of the priesthood, which had actually gone extinct virtually. I mean, by the time Jesus came, the priesthood was for sale of the highest bidder. The high priesthood often went to the sale of the highest bidder, and the priesthood, it was just waxing old. But there was going to be a renewing of all that in the church, and Joshua and his colleague priest were wonder signs pointing ahead and pointing forward to this. In verse 9, this stone seems to be the same stone that old King Nebuchadnezzar saw in Daniel chapter 2, verse 34. A stone cut out of the mountainside without hands, meaning by divine agency, which smote the image on the feet. And in Daniel 2, 44, we're told that it was going to stand forever. He's talking about the church there. Joshua and the other priests are told to look at that stone because it's deserving of their close consideration, their observation. There are seven eyes here which indicate a complete Seven indicates completeness, and eyes represent intelligence in this kind of prophetic language. Perfect intelligence, or an omniscience here. This, the Son of God, who is the head of the church, has that. And he's a part of this stone. The omniscience of God is directed on the church in his loving care. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. All things are naked and open under the eyes of him with whom we have to do. There's an all-seeing eye watching you. That's the idea behind these eyes, I think. The seven eyes observing the stone in watchful care are the eyes of God. We see this again in chapter 4, verse 10. The work on this stone is not completed. The Lord is going to engrave the graving thereof. He will beautify it. He will make her crude and shapeless form an object of beauty, carefully wrought by himself. Engraving requires careful effort, but achieves long-lasting results. So he says, I will remove the iniquity of the land in one day. What day was that? I have a theory in where I postulate that the day referred to as that day in the book of Zechariah is the day that Jesus was crucified. It seems that so many, many times we go back to that. In that one day, the day of the crucifixion, the day when the Lord shed his blood, the purchase price for the cleansing from iniquity so that we can get rid of the ruined, filthy garments and put the new garments on. It's only the Lord's sacrifice that makes this possible. One day and one work suffice. He died once for all people, once for all time. The Old Testament sacrifices furnished the implied contrast of endless repetition and yet no actual removal of guilt. The guilt was taken off of the person, but it wasn't actually dealt with in the animal sacrifices. That was all waiting till the blood of Christ would wipe away all that accumulation of filth. The sacrifice on Calvary holds good for all time. This is a faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. And on that one day of the crucifixion, that's what triggered all of the rest of this action that we're seeing here. So in verse 10, when sin and its guilt are removed, then nothing can mar the outward peace. Dwelling under one's own vine and fig tree was an Old Testament picture of a happy prosperity. People would generally say, it doesn't get any better than this. If you're under your own vine and your own fig tree, and you got your children round about, and you're at a happy home life, it just doesn't get any better than that. This is the picture of contentment and security. So we're blending here the physical and the spiritual realities together in this one picture, because that's the way God sees it. Okay, questions or thoughts over that vision in verse 4, the fourth vision, chapter 3, the fourth vision. Okay, we can do just a little bit of the fifth vision in chapter 4. And once again, the entire chapter is the vision here, the fifth vision. I'm going to go ahead and read that. And I don't know how much we'll be able to talk about it because our time is drawing nigh, but we'll get it read anyway. And the angel that talked with me came again and waked me, as a man that is waked out of his sleep. And he said unto me, what seest thou? And I said, I have looked, and behold, a candlestick, all of gold, with a bowl upon the top of it, and his seven lamps thereon, and seven pipes to the seven lamps which are upon the top thereof. And two olive trees by it, one upon the right side of the bowl, and the other upon the left side thereof. So I answered and spake to the angel that talked with me, saying, what are these, my Lord? Then the angel that talked with me answered and said unto me, knowest thou not what these be? And I said, no, my Lord. Then he answered and spake unto me, saying, this is the word of the Lord unto Zerubbabel, saying, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord of hosts. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain. He shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, grace, grace unto it. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hand shall also finish it. And thou shalt know the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto you. For who hath despised the day of small things? For they shall rejoice and shall see the plummet in the hand of Zerubbabel with those seven. They are the eyes of the Lord, which run to and fro through the whole earth. Then answered I and said unto him, What are these two olive trees upon the right side of the candlestick and upon the left side thereof? And I answered again and said unto him, What be these two olive branches which through the two golden pipes empty the golden oil out of themselves? And he answered me and said, Knowest thou not what these be? And I said, No, my Lord. Then he said, These are the two anointed ones that stand by the Lord of the whole earth. Okay, quite a lot here, and a very important one of these visions. This is the fifth vision, the vision of the golden lampstand and the two olive trees. The fourth vision that we just looked at in the previous chapter is dealing with moral obstacles, the filthiness, the filthy clothes that needed to be changed. Here we have, in the fifth vision, political obstacles and how they could possibly be dealt with. Now, in verse 1, I think we're being told there that Zechariah had seen the first four visions while he was fully awake. That's what a vision is. And deeply interested. But the strain of all that had exhausted him. This is going into the night here. And the strain of it all had exhausted him so much that he fell into a stupor. He fell asleep for a second. Similar to the way on the Mount of Transfiguration, the disciples were overcome by drowsiness in a somewhat analogous situation in the ninth chapter of the book of Luke, verse 32. So the angel wakes him up, because these are visions to be seen, not dreams. In verses 2 and 3, we have the menorah, or the lampstand, called a candlestick in the King James Version, but we ought not to think of a tallow candle sticking up out of a candle holder. This is a lampstand, and I think most of the translations probably read that way. Though this lampstand is patterned after the tabernacle or the temple model, it has three distinctive features. In the tabernacle, a seven-branched candelabra was placed on the south side of the tabernacle. Its lamps were trimmed and filled with pure olive oil every morning and lighted every evening to burn during the night. In Solomon's temple, there were 10 similar candelabra which were placed there. But in Zechariah's lampstand here, over its head is a rounded bowl from which oil is continually supplied to the lamps. So no human being has to go and supply it with oil like they did in the tabernacle. This is continually supplied by some other source. And there are seven pipes running from this bowl to maybe to each of the lamps, which would be a total of 49 pipes. I'm not sure about that, but we do seem to have a distributive idea of seven each here, as we have in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 6, and 2 Samuel 21, verse 20. Some people think there were only seven pipes. Some think there were 49. In either case, this lampstand is well supplied. And also there are two olive trees, which is a living source of more and more oil. If you just had the bowl of oil up there, eventually it would run out. But you've got two olive trees, which are alive and continually in their life, producing more and more oil on either side of the bowl and directly feeding into the bowl. So the branches are over it and the oil is just dripping out of it there and to feed the bowl, and then the bowl in turn feeds the lamps. So I believe this lampstand typifies the people of God, just as the seven lampstands in the book of Revelation typify the people of God. But I see I'd almost forgot to look at the clock again. So Ed loves to study the Bible, and I appreciate that very much. But if we want everybody to come back tomorrow night, we better close now, I guess. And do we have anything else to say before we close? If not, Denny, would you be willing to lead us in dismissal prayer?